On Sunday, July 23rd, Abby and Bill met David Alford, his photographer John Cleave, and the four boarded the plane and set out for America. Abby had been included in the plan soon after Bill met David Alford. He would not have made the trip without her. Bill was excited about the prospects of the trip, but still worried that even at this late date he was falling prey to attacks. Flying across the ocean was thrilling for both Abby and Bill. They got to play typical tourists. They saw the vast ocean stretching to the horizons. They passed through what seemed like miles of clouds, and they were treated to the sight of a sunset as seen from an airplane. Other passengers might get bored on a transatlantic flight, but not Abby and Bill Ramsey. New York was overwhelming. As big and sprawling as London was, nothing could have prepared them for the crush and mayhem of Manhattan, even as seen from the air. A rental car was waiting. The four drove the 60 miles to the Stout Hill Motel in Bethel, Connecticut. Here they called it a day. They were exhausted. Abby recalls,
"I still couldn't quite believe it. Being in America, I mean. Everything looked different. Bigger and brighter and more lavish somehow. Even the countryside, which was very green with summer, seemed spectacular. That first night I was tempted to walk around the small town, a window-shopping expedition, I suppose. But I decided I'd better stay with Bill. He was very tired and drawn. I'd long had the theory that some of his attacks were caused by exhaustion, when he couldn't control his impulses so well. And I knew he was worried about having another attack. After the night he'd slammed our dog across the room, Bill was very concerned that we'd get to America and he'd go berserk or something. There's a certain stress that comes from traveling, no matter how nice your hosts are, and I think he was feeling that keenly the night we were in Bethel. We found a movie on the TV, something with Tony Curtis, a Yank actor we'd always enjoyed. Bill fell asleep early, completely done in. I sat up and watched most of the movie. I was just starting to doze off, knowing I'd have to get up and shut off the TV, when I heard a familiar and terrifying sound. A growl was working itself up from Bill's chest, a deep, rumbling, angry sound. His eyes flew open. After a long moment, I realized that these were not my husband's eyes at all. They were the darker, glistening, furious eyes of another species. I didn't want to scream and alarm Bill. I reached out my hand and placed it on his naked shoulder. The eyes of another species still glared at me. "Bill," I said gently. "Bill, this is Abby. I love you. I love you, Bill, and I want you to stop this. Do you understand me, Bill? Do you understand me?" The rumbling, like that of a summer storm, continued in his chest and throat, but as I spoke, the glare of the eyes began to soften, and in them, if only glimpsingly, I could see the gaze of the man I loved. "Bill, please stop this. Get control of yourself." I'm not sure how long we stayed on the bed staring at each other, or how long my hand rested on his shoulder, but slowly I saw the evil spirit withdraw from his consciousness, saw Bill slowly return to being Bill, the animal spirit in him subsiding now. In the morning, while I was fixing my hair in the bathroom, Bill came in, rubbing his face, and said, "I had a strange dream last night." "Oh?" "I dreamt that I woke up and found myself trapped inside the wolf's body." I looked at him in the mirror, so pale and sad. I didn't know if I should tell him. "You were there too," he said. "You helped me through it just the way you did in our living room." His anger was sudden and intimidating. He slammed his fist into the wall and said, "If the Warrens can't help me, I don't know what'll happen to us, Abby. I'm afraid to think about it." For one of the few times in his life, Bill seemed almost eager to try to cleanse himself of his anger and sorrow. I took him in my arms and held him for a long time, deciding against telling him about last night. As I stood there, all I could do was offer a few fragile, silent prayers. Bill was right. If the Warrens couldn't help us, then there probably was no hope. Our lives together would be an unending series of attacks. "I'm sure everything will be all right, Bill," I said, still holding him and stroking his back. "I'm sure it will." But I wasn't sure that I believed that myself.
Interview with Ed and Lorraine Warren. You've known Bishop Robert McKenna a long time, haven't you?
Oh, yes. Nearly 20 years now.
Bishop McKenna is what's called a traditionalist Catholic. Can you explain that?
That means that the bishop broke with the church after the Second Vatican Council 25 years ago, when Rome insisted that the Mass be said in English and that other fundamental changes in faith be altered too. Father McKenna found that many lay Catholics agreed with him. His parish was filled every Sunday morning with the faithful who chose to follow the old ways.
So he then became involved in the traditionalist movement?
Yes. In fact, the leaders of the movement made him a bishop.
You'd worked previously with the bishop on exorcisms?
Yes. He's the most knowledgeable cleric we've ever worked with. He studied the history of demonic infestation and how to deal with it.
Then his exorcisms are always successful?
Oh, no, not always. Remember, sometimes we're dealing with demons who are nearly as powerful as Satan himself, or who are Satan in a different form. Bishop McKenna is a modest man. He makes no false claims about his exorcisms. Usually they work, but not always.
The other thing about Bishop McKenna is that he wants nothing for himself. No money, no publicity. He's a very earnest and devout man. You just don't see his kind around a lot anymore. He's definitely of the old school, and that's why he's always so eager to help people who are about at the end of their rope.
You'd told him about Bill Ramsey?
Oh, yes. We spoke with the bishop for hours. We told him everything we knew about Bill Ramsey.
And he agreed that it sounded as if Bill were possessed?
Yes. That was the bishop's first response. He felt this was a clear case of demonic infestation.
He found the young Bill Ramsey's experience in his parents' backyard the day he tore the fence post out significant?
Yes. The bishop said that it sounded as if the demon had first accosted Bill then.
Where was the exorcism to take place?
The bishop's church is in Monroe, Connecticut, a very pretty little town. It's like stepping into a different era, slow and peaceful and very, very pleasant.
Was the bishop afraid? Haven't people who have conducted exorcisms been injured?
The bishop's faith kept him from being afraid, but he was well aware, of course, that some priests, while they've been conducting exorcisms, have been attacked by demons.
Haven't there even been deaths?
So we've been told.
So there was no hesitation on the bishop's part?
None whatsoever. He was very eager to help Bill. We'd told the bishop everything that Bill had gone through, especially the humiliation of being put in a mental hospital. And so the bishop very genuinely wanted to help Bill. He spent many hours praying that the Lord would help him make this a very successful exorcism.
Were you nervous?
Not nervous, exactly. A little apprehensive, I suppose. For one thing, an exorcism is usually very stressful. There's a lot at stake, and sometimes the demons can become very frightening. There'll be strange noises and strange colors and terrible odors, and it's not always pleasant. There were certainly more enjoyable ways of spending an afternoon or an evening.
How about you, Lorraine? Were you nervous?
I'd agree with what Ed said. Apprehensive. The Ramseys had come all the way over from England. Their children and their friends were praying for them. The People newspaper had spent a great deal of time and money on the trip. They'd even sent along a journalist and a photographer. There was a lot at stake. So naturally, I felt some pressure.
How did the Ramseys hold up?
I wish everybody was as nice to work with as Bill and Abby. They were grateful for everything that had been done for them, and they were truly enjoying their first look at America. It was a lot of fun showing them around and listening to them remark on different things we saw.
Did the Ramseys meet the bishop beforehand?
Oh, yes. Bishop McKenna always likes to meet the subjects in advance, explain to them what's going to happen, and ask them about themselves. They had a very long talk. They liked the bishop immediately, really trusted him, and felt comfortable with him. And that was very important.
The exorcism was about to take place then?
Yes, the day following the Tuesday we introduced the Ramses to the bishop.
Everything was set?
Everything was set, yes.
A Cynical Man. In a town as small as this one, it is difficult to keep a secret, which is how a reporter named Chuck Vogel learned about the forthcoming exorcism. As a reporter for a county newspaper, Vogel didn't often get a chance to cover anything resembling a real story. He usually found himself covering local fairs, one-alarm fires, and county supervisor meetings where the supervisors rewarded various cousins and cronies with pork-barrel contracts. At 37, Vogel was well aware that he was never going to win a Pulitzer Prize, never going to work on a newspaper with a circulation exceeding 10,000, and never going to drive anything better than a 10-year-old Dodge with a bullet hole in the back window and scabrous rust consuming the right fender. But if nothing else, Vogel had himself a potential story now. Sometimes in his travels, he drove three counties over to visit a divorced woman he'd been dating occasionally for the past 6 months. She didn't much care for Vogel's fondness for beer, his profane sense of humor, or his ill-concealed contempt for her ex-husband, a factory worker and biker whose nickname was Adolf, because of his self-professed respect for the Nazi leader. She had let Vogel sleep with her only four times, and nothing in those moments had been especially pleasant, all of them ending in hard, bitter tears and snuffly speeches about how much she missed Adolf, and how he was a real man, unlike certain unnamed journalists she could name. Vogel had no idea why he kept coming back. Maybe because he'd never been particularly successful with women anyway, and because he had absolutely nothing else going in his life right now. But come back he did. On one of his multi-county trips to see the Widow Bailey, as he referred to her, he happened to stop in a little diner not far from Danbury, and that's where he heard it. The story about the English guy who thought he was a werewolf. The story about the bishop named McKenna who was going to perform an exorcism. The story about the other reporters from England. And suddenly Chuck Vogel felt as if God had finally looked down on him and given him a little smile. Not a big smile, but a smile nonetheless. Because Chuck Vogel was now hot on the trail of a real story. Boy, were the readers of his conservative little county newspaper going to be shaken up. Looking for garden club news, looking for tips on when to plant corn, they were going to go crazy over the chilling saga of a guy who claimed to be a werewolf and a traditionalist bishop who said he was in contact with demonic forces. Chuck Vogel felt as if he were 23 years old again and starting his life all over. He paid for his black coffee, winked at the cute waitress behind the cash register, and left. On the drive back to his hometown, Chuck stopped off and visited the church where the exorcism was to take place. In mid-afternoon, sunlight streaming through the windows and the scent of incense giving the air a melancholy edge, Chuck had once been an altar boy, and incense always brought back a lot of memories. Chuck walked around and found a perfect place to hide during the exorcism. Here he could stand and watch and snap a few photographs and leave before anybody knew what had happened. He went back to his car, found a good loud rock and roll station, and put the Dodge to the floor, which in this case meant getting it up to 61 miles per hour, a land speed record for this old rattle-trap. By the time he reached his two-room apartment with its water-stained walls and no handle on the toilet, he was having second thoughts about the Pulitzer. Maybe he was going to win it after all.
"A what?"
his boss said that evening.
"An exorcism."
"You mean like in that movie?"
"I mean like in that movie."
"With her head spinning around and puking up green stuff?"
"Well, not necessarily that kind of thing, but an exorcism. A real one."
Peterson was his boss's name. Like Vogel, Peterson had been a graduate of the State University's Journalism School, 1947, and like Vogel, he'd had big dreams of working on a city newspaper and covering murders and prostitution and all the other things that make a reporter's life worthwhile. But when he'd graduated, the economy had been in a post-World War II slump, and he'd been forced to scramble. Ultimately, he'd ended up out in the boonies, getting a bank loan and taking over ownership of this dinky county newspaper, where not only was he publisher, editor, and sole reporter, he was also in charge of advertising. He had had to suffer the indignity of going to every merchant in the county and pleading for advertising. Reporters weren't supposed to do things like that. Journalism was about truth and justice, not about sales on chuck roast and girdles. But do it he did. And now it was many decades later, and he was fat and bald and had suffered two strokes, and he was looking forward to retiring just as soon as Vogel got his bank loan and took over the county newspaper for himself. In the meantime, Peterson was still boss, and like all bosses everywhere, it was his sworn duty to get mad when his boneheaded employee came up with a particularly boneheaded idea.
An exorcism.
An exorcism, yes, sir.
And you think our readers will like it?
I think our readers will love it.
Puking up pea soup.
Puking up pea soup.
God help me.
God help us all, said Vogel, demonstrating his love for mankind.
And then Peterson started laughing. His big belly started shaking, and then his jowls started shaking, and his cigarette hack started chopping the air, and tears started running down his cheeks. And he looked exactly like Santa Claus, after a six-pack or so.
An exorcism,
Peterson said, apparently finding a humor in all this that somehow eluded Vogel.
An exorcism? Well, I'll be damned.
Vogel was too much of a gentleman to point out that, indeed, Peterson probably would be damned.
Go to it, kiddo, Peterson said. Go to it.
An Innocent Abroad. Over the course of the next few days, Abby and Bill Ramsey spent part of their time preparing for the upcoming exorcism and part of their time sightseeing. America, with its shopping malls and vast array of restaurants and curiously pastoral countryside, fascinated them. This was summer, and a mild summer, and so the natural beauty they saw was gentle. They'd been told that every once in a while summer was so hot that it was barely tolerable. Bill notes, "Everybody involved insisted on certain health tests for me. This took a while, and not all the tests worked out in that some were inconclusive. Dr. Andy DeMarco gave me a complete physical examination and pronounced me fit. He did insist, however, that I have my heart checked on an EKG machine. Dr. DeMarco was worried about the effects that an exorcism would have on me. The doctor had actually witnessed exorcisms, and he knew that the stress would be unbelievable. Dr. DeMarco had arranged an appointment for me with a clinic. I'd be tested there to see how much stress I could handle. Then we went to meet Bishop McKenna." The bishop was in all ways a modest man. He lived modestly. He spoke modestly. And he talked of his skills as an exorcist modestly.
"I don't always succeed, Bill," the bishop said in his study that bright green afternoon. "I hope you understand that."
"Yes, Father, I do.
Only by cleansing your soul and praying devoutly can we draw God's power down to help us."
"I understand, Father."
Bishop McKenna studied Bill a moment.
"You've suffered, haven't you?"
"Yes, Father."
"It's not just for yourself that you want this exorcism to work, is it?"
"No, Father. I want it to work for the sake of my family. In many ways, they've suffered even more than I have."
"The Lord will reward the way you love your family."
Bill nodded.
"Did they tell you about the EKG?"
"Yes, Father."
"Did they tell you that I ordered it?"
"No, Father."
Bishop McKenna nodded his venerable head slowly. He looked comfortable in this small but well-appointed study. You could feel the decades that had passed in this room. The bishop said,
You will be a wild animal when we begin to purge your soul.
I see.
And there will be guards there.
Guards?
Yes.
To protect me.
I wouldn't try to hurt you, Father.
Not now, you wouldn't.
Not when you're in control of yourself, Bill, but tomorrow.
The bishop shook his head.
I've asked the guards to carry stun guns. Do you know what they are?
They would freeze me in my tracks.
Exactly. The police use them all the time.
But why would I need an EKG for that?
Bill said.
Because a stun gun can put extra stress on your heart.
The bishop said.
I want to be safe, and I also want you to be safe.
I appreciate your concern, Father.
The bishop rose and put forth his hand.
I'll see you tomorrow, then, Bill. May God bless us both.
With that, the bishop walked Bill to the front door.
The Long Dark Night. The night before the exorcism, Abby lay awake. Next to her, Bill slept fitfully. Occasionally, headlights from the road outside the motel would paint images of light on the dark wall and then vanish. She wondered what it would be like to be in a big, fast American car and to be hurtling through the night, plenty of money in your pockets, headed to the West Coast, with its promise of Hollywood stars and the creatures and rides of Disneyland. She wished she were in just such a car, Bill right next to her, and that they were sailing down the dark highway now. As she lay there, she tried not to think about the exorcism the next morning. Much as she liked the Warrens, Abby had her doubts that the ceremony would achieve its desired effect. What if, following the ceremony, Bill's attacks continued? Who could they turn to then? The luminous hands on Abby's travel alarm read 4:16 a.m. when she finally slumped over and dozed off. Sleep felt wonderful, refreshing. Her entire body had finally relaxed. But not long after, her eyes flew open, and she sat straight up in bed, her body tense. In the darkness, she could hear the low, feral growl coming from Bill's chest. But unlike the other night, Bill didn't lie there passively. Even though he was still asleep, the spirit had possessed him completely. He slowly sat up in bed, the sheet falling away from him, and turned to face Abby. His eyes were the color of blood rubies, and she could see, even in the shadows, how his lips were pulled back from his teeth as his claw-like hands reached out for her.
"Bill!"
she shouted, trying to scramble off the bed before he could grab her, but she was not quick enough. Bill got hold of the strap on her nightie and pulled her back to him.
"Bill!"
she cried again, but now he was on top of her, and they were wrestling around on the bed. She had no doubt about what he wanted to do— to tear at her flesh with his white, snapping teeth. She knew she was giving into panic as she tried to push her husband away. She knew that if she was to save herself and help him at the same time, she would have to compose herself and speak to him, as she had that night at home when he'd hurt their dog.
"Bill,"
she said calmly, still using the heels of her hands to push his face away from her throat.
"Bill, I want you to stop this."
There in the darkness, as Bill's growling grew angrier than ever, her soft-spoken words sounded almost pathetic. How could such a sweet, soft voice stop the crazed beast that Bill had become? As she held his biceps to push him away, she could feel the tightness of his entire body. Long slabs of muscles in his back reminded her of a dog's. Or a wolf's.
"Bill!"
He tried once again to sink his teeth into her throat. Not with the precision of a vampire, but with a rage of an animal crazed by its own fury. He wanted to rip her whole throat out, leaving nothing more than a hot, bloody hole.
"Bill, I want you to stop. Please, Bill, I want you to stop."
His hands found her throat then, and he started choking her, the way he had the policeman Brad Busby. By now his strength was overpowering. His hot spittle sprayed her face, his hands on her throat pressed tighter and tighter. For a terrible moment, she began to see images of her life pass her by. Her life, she knew, was ending. Her own husband was going to choke her to death in their motel room. The seediness of the situation depressed her. She was a proud woman,
from proud people, and she did not want to die this way. Bill continued to choke her. By now his growling was so loud, her ears were literally ringing. Then she managed to hit him hard with the heel of her hand at the base of his jaw, hard enough to knock his hands away momentarily. She rolled off the bed, slamming against the floor. He came scrambling off like a berserk animal, trying to grab her once more. She managed to crawl over to the desk. Quickly, she grabbed an empty soda bottle she'd set there the night before. At least she had a weapon now, however modest it might be. As Bill started to rush at her, and now he was on all fours and his eyes were once again the color of blood rubies, she brought the bottle behind her head and got ready to strike him with it.
"Bill, I love you."
She hadn't thought he'd even hear her words. She spoke so softly anyway, and his growling was still very loud. But when she said this, she saw a painful recognition begin to show in his blood-ruby eyes, as if at least a part of him had suddenly recognized who she was and what he was about to do to her. She said it again.
"Bill, I love you."
And he stopped then, right there, in the middle of the motel floor. All she could hear for a time was the panting sound he made, and then the traffic noise from the highway. People were going to work early. The headlights of a passing car briefly lit Bill's face. She saw that he was slowly losing the wolf-like qualities she'd seen there only moments before, and was becoming her Bill again. He surprised her by speaking.
"Help me, Abby. Help me."
And then she took him in her arms and cradled him like a small child. "Oh, God, please see that the exorcism works. Please, Lord." Sometime near dawn he fell asleep that way, there on the floor, his head in her lap as her tender hands stroked his shoulders. "Oh, please, God, please."
No Sanctuary.
On the morning of the exorcism, Chuck Vogel woke early and staggered into the bathroom to get ready. He'd been drinking whiskey the night before, anticipating the sweet pleasure of covering the exorcism as a secret witness, and his pounding head testified to the fact that he'd overdone it. As he stood at the mirror, soaping his face with shaving cream, he looked closely at his features, wishing, as always, that he were handsome. And then he noticed the mark in the center of his forehead. As a Catholic, he always received the blessing of the candles on Ash Wednesday. He also had the priest put an ashy thumb in the center of his forehead, signifying that he was now ready for Lent. He always wore the small amount of ash on his forehead proudly. He was happy to be a Catholic and didn't care who knew it, despite the occasional jokes a few people made. This morning there was another kind of mark on his forehead. He leaned closer to peer at it, and then he remembered the dream. Hangovers always left him feeling shaky and sweaty and dehydrated, but this morning he felt as if he'd also come down with a bad case of the flu. But he kept leaning closer, closer, to study the mark on his forehead, and then he saw a pentagram. Somebody had stamped a pentagram, a five-pointed, star-like figure commonly associated with satanic worship, right there in the center of his forehead. Terrified, he ran cold water on his fingers and brought his fingers to his face. He tried rubbing the pentagram off. That didn't work. He added soap to the water and rubbed. That didn't work either. He ran the hot water, so hot that steam coated the silver mirror. First, he had to rub away the steam before he could try rubbing away the pentagram. A wildly absurd thought came to him. What if he were forced to walk around the rest of his life with a pentagram on his forehead? But then an even more ominous thought came to him. What if this were a warning from the dark forces to stay away from the church and the exorcism later in the day? An hour later, showered, shaved, and dressed, Chuck Vogel sat by the kitchen window of his tiny apartment. It was 11 in the morning on a hot July day in a town so small it was lucky to have a zip code. Down in the dusty street, four boys were playing kickball, and up on the corner, three old men sat out on a bench in front of the DX station, swigging orange soda and swatting flies away. In other words, a perfectly typical and peaceful summer day. Except for one thing. Somebody, or something, had burned a pentagram into the center of Chuck Vogel's forehead. He poured himself a third shot of whiskey. The stuff was raw on an empty stomach. He knew he shouldn't be drinking now, But he didn't care. The pentagram had scared him. The housekeeper, a stout woman in a faded house dress, showed Chuck Vogel into the den and excused herself to go get the Monsignor. This was a priest Chuck didn't know, in a town 50 miles from where he lived. He didn't want anybody in his small town to know what had happened to him. While he waited, Chuck checked out the considerable library, finding Chesterton and H.G. Wells and Jack London mixed in with religious books. Chuck wanted to lose himself in this nice little leather-bound room, stay here monkishly and read the rest of his life away. With the housekeeper occasionally bringing him food and slippers and a pipe for long winter nights. Right now, he didn't want to be Chuck Vogel, reporter. He wanted to be anybody else. The man who came in was short, suntanned, bald, and wore a lime-green golf shirt and yellow golf slacks. He was maybe 50 years old, and his blue-eyed gaze hinted at both intelligence and humor. He introduced himself as Monsignor McBride. He put out a sinewy hand to shake and then took a seat across from Chuck.
"Would you mind if I close the door?"
"Not at all. Let me do it."
The Monsignor got up, closed the door, then came back and sat down.
"Now, how may I help you?"
"The pentagram."
"The pentagram?"
"Yes, the one in the center of my forehead."
The humor in Monsignor McBride's gaze died.
"Oh.
You do see it, don't you?"
"I guess not."
Chuck leaned forward in his chair. He pointed a finger to his forehead.
"Right there. Right in the center."
"A pentagram?"
"Yes."
"A five-pointed star?"
"Yes."
"In the center of your forehead?"
"Yes, and you do see it, don't you, Monsignor?"
By now the Monsignor was leaning forward and squinting his eyes and staring hard at Chuck's forehead.
"No, I'm afraid I don't."
"But it's there."
"Not right now, it isn't."
"But just before I came in here, I looked in my rearview mirror and there it was, plain as day."
"I'm sorry."
"My God."
Chuck jumped to his feet. He started pacing, sweating, shaking.
"Could your housekeeper bring me a hand mirror?"
"I'll get you one."
Monsignor McBride stood up and pointed to Chuck's chair.
"Why don't you sit down? I'll be right back."
While the Monsignor was gone, Chuck's hands started shaking so badly he could not control them. He felt humiliated and terrified and totally confused. The pentagram had been there. He had no doubt about that. None whatsoever. The Monsignor offered a tiny, apologetic smile when he came back in.
"I had to borrow our housekeeper's hand mirror. I don't use them myself."
He handed an ornately carved plastic hand mirror to Chuck.
"Here you go."
Frantically, Chuck brought the mirror to his face and looked at himself. He was so relieved he was afraid he was going to cry. It hadn't been his imagination. Right there in the center of his forehead was the pentagram. He took the mirror away and said,
"Look, Monsignor, there it is."
The Monsignor leaned closer, examining Chuck's skin the way a dermatologist would, but he said,
"I'm afraid I still don't see it."
"What?"
Chuck said, bringing the mirror back to his face. The pentagram was still there, obstinate and ugly as ever.
"But, Monsignor,"
Chuck began, but before he could finish his sentence, the Monsignor raised his hand and said,
"Sit down. We need to talk."
The Monsignor went over and closed the den door and then came back and sat down.
"Now," he said, "tell me what you've been doing that would invite Satan into your life."
For the next 20 minutes, Chuck told the priest his story. Monsignor McBride listened without comment or question. Chuck told him all the things he'd seen and heard in the church yesterday, none of it threatening, and then how he'd told all this to his sometime girlfriend. Only then, when he described their relationship, did a flicker of priestly disapproval show in the Monsignor's eyes. Chuck was sure that the priest would like to see the couple married and in the good graces of the church. Finally, when Chuck finished and sat back in his chair, Monsignor McBride said,
"Did you dream last night?"
I think so."
"You're not sure?"
"No, well, wait, maybe I am."
"You remember something?"
Chuck thought a moment. A horrible image filled his mind.
Yes, I did dream.
Will you tell me about it?
I was being pursued by this lovely young woman. I don't know why I wanted to escape her. I mean, ordinarily, I...
He stopped himself. He didn't want to tell a priest that ordinarily in his dreams he would have gladly let himself be caught by such a beauty and spend a long and pleasant dream sequence with her.
You kept running?
Yes, Monsignor.
Do you know why?
Chuck's mind filled once more with a terrible image.
Because she wasn't a beautiful young woman at all.
No?
No. When she got very close to me, I glanced back at her and I saw that she was this diseased hag. She looked like something that had come up from the grave.
The Monsignor looked straight at him.
They don't want you there.
Who doesn't?
Do I really have to tell you who I mean, Chuck?
Chuck shook his head.
I guess not.
He thought a moment.
But why wouldn't they want me there?
Maybe they don't want a reporter to witness what's going to happen during the exorcism.
I never thought about that.
It seemed such a peculiar subject to be discussing on such a sunny afternoon, especially with a priest who wore bright yellow and lime green golf clothes.
Stay away from the church, Chuck.
Seriously?
Quite seriously.
Chuck shook his head.
But this pentagram on my forehead,
only you can see it. And that's the way they want it. They want to discredit you, make people think you're crazy. Because that way, if you report anything... You see what I'm talking about?
Monsignor McBride leaned forward in his chair.
Go home, Chuck. Straight home. Whatever you do, don't stop at that church, do you understand?
Chuck nodded.
But what about the pentagram on my forehead?
You won't see it any more after the exorcism's over, if they can complete it.
If?
The Monsignor nodded.
You see what they've been able to do. Well, just imagine the trouble they've got in mind for the exorcism.
You're right. I never thought of that.
Monsignor McBride stood up, offered his hand.
Go to your apartment and close the windows and lock the doors and stay there till tomorrow.
Thank you, Monsignor. I really appreciate it.
Hurry, Chuck. Hurry.
Less than 2 minutes later, Chuck was in his car and driving the 50 miles back to the small town where he lived. The Frightening Journey. The morning of the exorcism, Bill Ramsey awoke and sat on the side of the bed, knowing that today his life would change one way or another. Either the spirit of the werewolf would be driven out of him, or he would be forced to resign himself to his fate. He still had not ruled out the possibility of suicide. Shortly after Bill stepped out of the shower, Ed Warren called.
How you feeling?
All right, Bill said.
Then,
nervous.
Everything will be fine. You wait and see.
As Bill spoke, his eyes roamed the room. He saw a chair with a leg that had been broken. The leg had been fine the night before. A sense of dread overcame him. He said nothing of this to Ed.
We'll be there in about an hour, Ed said. Then we'll all go to the church together.
Fine. I appreciate that.
There was a long pause on Ed's end of the line.
Bill?
Yes.
You'd tell me if something was wrong, wouldn't you?
Yes.
But Bill was still staring at the chair. Something had happened in this room last night. He struggled to remember, but his mind offered no images or memories of any kind, just the cold chill of dread. Of what might have happened. Of what he'd possibly done.
I'll see you in an hour, Ed,
Bill said, and gently hung up. He sat on the edge of the bed, waiting for her. She came out of the bathroom wrapped in a towel. She went over to her things and started getting dressed. He watched her for a long time before saying anything. He said,
Abby.
She was fixing her hair in the mirror. Her eyes met his in their reflection.
Yes?
It happened again last night, didn't it?
She quickly shifted her gaze to herself, so she wouldn't have to look at him.
Abby,
"Answer me, please,"
softly she said.
"You don't remember anything?"
"No." She paused.
"Maybe it's just as well."
"But, Abby, I..." He could see vague bruises on her neck.
"Had he..."
He buried his face in his hands and sat there for a long time. She came over and sat next to him on the edge of the bed. She rubbed his shoulders and then slid her arms around him and held him.
"It's going to be all right," she said. "I have faith in the Warrens and Bishop McKenna."
"But what if it's not?"
"It will be. I promise."
"I just wish I could remember."
"Believe me, it's just as well you don't."
"It was that bad."
She stood up, smiled.
"Come on. Ed said he'd be here in an hour. We'd better hurry."
He reached out and took her hand.
"I don't know why you put up with me."
She laughed.
"Neither do I."
Then she kissed him on the forehead.
"Must mean I love you. Don't know what else it could mean, do you?"
Despite what lay ahead, Abby had made him feel better for this moment. He lay on the bed and thought of all the bright new sights he'd seen on this American trip. For a luxurious moment, he forgot all about what had brought him to these shores. He just enjoyed himself. And then he looked at the broken chair leg, the way the chair canted to the left now.
"My God, what if I'd killed her? What if..."
"Better come in and finish getting ready,"
she called from the bathroom. He went in and did just that. There were less than 2 hours to go before the exorcism. He didn't have to ask himself why his hands were twitching. A bad mistake. Shortly after Bill and Abby Ramsey joined the Warrens for a light lunch before going to the church, Chuck Vogel pulled into town. He was coming from the east, back from the church where he'd met Monsignor McBride. He knew he should take a right after reaching the town limits sign. Instinct told him that going past the small white church was not a good idea, but for some reason, he drove past anyway, and stopped. He sat there so long that the car behind him started honking. Chuck pulled over to the curb. For the next 10 minutes, he did absolutely nothing else but sit there and stare at the church. He had no idea why, but it was as if he'd been hypnotized. He could not take his eyes from the church doorway. As a reporter, he didn't like being censored in any way. He supposed this was the reason he was so fascinated with the small white church across the street. He wanted to go in there to prove he could go in there, that he wasn't afraid, and that he didn't take orders, not even from a Monsignor. 15 minutes later, feeling chilly and sick to his stomach, Chuck Vogel climbed out of his 10-year-old Dodge and started across the dusty street to the church. Distantly, he could hear children playing in the early afternoon, and a lawnmower churning through some thick grass and a radio playing rock and roll music. A typical day, at least on the surface. Rick walked straight up to the front door of the church and pulled on the handle. It was unlocked. He went inside. The interior was shadowy and cool, which only added to the strange chills that ran up and down his body. He looked around, the baptismal font, the altar, the confessionals. Everything looked fine and regular and normal. Nothing to be upset about at all.
"I shouldn't have come in here."
All of a sudden he knew he'd made a mistake coming in there. A darkness fell on the interior of the church then. Even though sunlight could be seen pressed against the stained glass windows, the interior was as dark as during an autumnal dusk. He heard the door of a confessional open. And when he turned to look, he saw a shambling, hellish creature with open sores on its face and eyes the color of blood rubies. The creature, wrapped in the rags of a homeless person, started walking up the center aisle toward Chuck. And Chuck ran. He ran like a frightened 8-year-old. And he ran without shame. He went out the side door to where the sun was shining, to where the birds sang, to where people spent their time lying in hammocks and watching Red Sox games. He'd made a terrible mistake coming here, and now he just wanted to keep going, as far and as fast as he could travel. Within 20 minutes, Chuck was home in his apartment. He slipped both deadbolts on and got his .38 out from his drawer.
He loaded it and set it on the nightstand next to his sagging double bed. From the refrigerator he took a quart of Ham's beer. It took him a few minutes to get situated, but at last he was comfortable. Propped up on the bed, the TV across the room turned to a ball game, and his front door in full view, in case some shambling creature with open wounds and filthy rags tried to get in. He'd been very stupid to go into the church a while ago. Very stupid. And very lucky. He was sensible enough, before losing himself in the Red Sox game, to offer a prayer of thanks for his good fortune. He made a vow to never again show any interest in the supernatural, no matter how good a news story he could get. The Exorcism. Bishop Robert McKenna is a small man with light brown hair, eyeglasses, and a gentle voice. His large, powerful hands reflect his enormous inner strength, the strength that has comforted thousands of people throughout the years of his priesthood. His powerful hands also reflected the strength he'd learned growing up poor. And these same hands had performed more than 50 exorcisms, 20 of which had been successful. The exorcism, one of the most ancient rituals of the Roman Catholic Church, was about to begin. The priest wears a purple stole around his neck to symbolize penance, and thus humility, while he begs God through prayers to free the demon-haunted person. Similarly, part of the ritual consists of adjurations to the devil, demanding that Satan, in the name of Christ, the Blessed Virgin, and all the saints, be gone at once. In some cases, the ritual consists of the priest's demand that the spirit or spirits who have caused the infestation speak out and identify themselves. Bishop McKenna has talked with many demons in the course of performing his exorcisms. Finally, in the course of the exorcism, special instruments, holy water, a crucifix, and a relic of a saint, are applied to the body in the same fashion, touched to the head or breast, for example. Despite the portrayals seen in recent movies, there is no chanting or singing at exorcisms. The priest prays in a loud, strong voice and, in the instance of Bishop McKenna, does so in Latin, Dominus vobiscum, the Lord be with you. Thus, the ritual began. In the church sat Ed and Lorraine Warren, Bill and Abby Ramsey, and four off-duty policemen who had been hired by the bishop. He knew he could not defend himself if Bill, in the throes of his exorcism, attacked him. Also present were David Alford and John Cleave, respectively the writer and photographer from The People, the newspaper that had paid the Ramseys' fare and accommodations. Ed and Lorraine offered their own prayers for the success of this day. Abby closed her eyes and thought of all their family had been through. She could only hope that all the bad things would stop today. Ed recalls, "I could sense Bill becoming very troubled the moment we stepped into the church. The demonic spirit within him was trying to desperately keep Bill under its control. We've seen this many times. One time, at the last minute, a man backed out of being exorcised because he said he was too sick to go on. Of course he was sick, and the demon had made him that way." Lorraine adds, "Bill looked very weak as he made his way up to the front of the church. I wondered if he was going to make it all right. There are special prayers I say at these times, and I certainly said them at this point. I prayed for Abby, too. She was very tightly wound and apprehensive." Bill sat alone now in a chair facing the altar. Bishop McKenna approached him, said a few more words in Latin, and then demanded aloud that the demon identify itself and then leave Bill's body forever. Bill just sat there and stared at the bishop. He sensed already that the ceremony was going to fail. Indeed, a few times he almost smiled when the bishop began to shout in Latin. There was something comic in the whole thing. Mumbo-jumbo was all Bill could think of. Abby was feeling pretty much the same way. She wasn't sure what she'd expected, but whatever it had been, this wasn't it. Everything here seemed so commonplace. There was no other way to describe it. The church was just a church. The priest was just a priest, and the ceremony itself sounded like something out of a horror movie. None of these things would help her husband in any way. Bishop McKenna said, "I could feel and see what Bill could not. The demonic spirit in him was beginning to fight me through Bill. It was going to be a struggle, but right from the start I felt that the exorcism would be successful.
I rarely have this kind of optimism.
For Bill, however, nothing special was going on. Ed and Lorraine Warren knew better, of course. They had attended many exorcisms, and they knew that before anything could happen, the bishop first had to make contact with the demon. This was a slow process. 5 minutes became 10, and 10 became 20. Ed and Lorraine continued offering up their silent prayers. 30 minutes into the exorcism, Father McKenna stepped forward and touched the stole he was wearing to Bill's forehead. Bishop McKenna then took Bill's head firmly in his hands and ordered the werewolf to be banished forever.
"I've seen dope addicts go into withdrawal, and that was all I could think of when Bill started thrashing around in his chair," says the bishop. "He didn't know it, but at that point he was fighting the demon for the control of his body and soul. I could see his face phase into and out of its wolf look. One moment he'd be himself. The next moment his face would start to suggest a feral quality. A wolf's face, in other words. I kept thinking of the fact that Bill's heart stress tests hadn't been completed."
This was the point in the exorcisms when some people had been known to die from the sheer physical stress. Only with great reluctance had the bishop agreed to the exorcism without the test. Bill continued to shake and writhe uncontrollably. He was having an attack, the worst one he'd ever known. He felt his lips pull back from his teeth, felt his hands become claws, felt the unmistakable urge to attack the bishop. And so he did. His hands reached up and attempted to rip open the bishop's face. Two of the burly off-duty policemen jumped up to grab Bill, but the bishop bravely ordered them back to their seats. The exorcism was going well, and he did not want to spoil it. The bishop then brought a crucifix out from somewhere inside his religious garments and pushed the cross into Bill's face. Bill, or more properly, the werewolf inside him, went berserk. He came up from his chair, snarling and growling and grasping at the bishop. Abby screamed. The Warrens worried that perhaps Bill would seriously hurt their friend, the bishop. Abby says,
"Suddenly, everything was a nightmare. Bill was going into one of his spells again. I kept thinking about how he'd tried to strangle me the other night. Would he now try to do the same thing to the bishop? It was hard to believe that the man I loved was this strange, enraged creature that resembled a wolf. I'd never seen his eyes this wild, not even the other night, or seen his hands look so much like wolf's claws. He jumped up from his seat and tried to attack the bishop again."
This time the priest had no choice but to retreat beyond the altar gate. Bill, spittle flying from his mouth, eyes wild, began to rush through the gate for the bishop. But the priest stood absolutely still now, holding his cross up once again and beginning to speak in Latin. And then something happened. Bill felt suddenly weak. He staggered back to his chair and threw himself in it. He could feel the coldness in his body begin to warm, and he felt his desire to attack the bishop begin to fade. Now the priest was back, standing over Bill and continuing his admonitions in Latin. Bill marvels.
"As I sat there, I felt myself becoming purified. The poison that had been in my body drained from me completely now, and I was left without any strength at all. I remember trying to turn around and look at Abby, but even that smaller movement blacked me out. I was afraid I was going to pitch forward on my head. I gripped the chair as tightly as I could and let the demon continue to be pushed away by Bishop McKenna's Latin words."
Bill could feel the spirit of the werewolf within himself, and its desire to destroy the religious man. But the werewolf's power was slipping quickly away. A faint roar sounded in Bill's chest, and then faded. He brought up his hands, but they were no longer claw-like. They were merely hands. Bill tried to push himself up from the chair for one last lunge at the bishop, but he found that his eyes were starting to close. He was losing consciousness, and, as he lost consciousness, he felt a great peace within himself, and an almost overpowering love for his wife and children. Afterward. A few days later, the Warrens took Bill and Abby Ramsey to the airport. For the past 48 hours, the Warrens had done little else than show the Ramseys around, letting them savor and enjoy their trip to America. Bill says,
"I kept trying to explain how I felt to everybody. I suppose I tried too often, but I couldn't help it. There was a little boy glee in me. I'd been freed from my prison. Nothing could have looked as good to me as America did right then. My mind took snapshots of the land and the people and the cities that I'll never lose. And then once every hour or so I'd pause and say, "Yes, it really happened. I came over here, and with the help of the Warrens and Bishop McKenna, I'm free for the first time in my life since I was 9 years old." Abby noticed the difference in Bill, too. She'd never seen him this relaxed and easygoing before. With Bill, there was always something held back, as if his mind's eye was focused on something else, which it was, certainly, the demon. I couldn't wait to tell the children about their father now, the laughter especially. He was really a new man. At the airport, the Warrens said their goodbyes. When the Ramsey's plane was announced, the Warrens helped them gather their things and then waited until the plane streaked into the air. Ed says today, "We stay in touch with the Ramseys. We always want to make sure that everything is all right. And thank God it is. Bill tells me that this is the best time in his life. That makes us very happy." Adds Lorraine, "Not all of our cases work out this well, but fortunately for the Ramseys, this one did. We owe a lot to Bishop McKenna. There's no more brave and caring a man in the United States. He's saved many, many lives, in both the physical and spiritual senses." Today, nearly 2 years later, Bill and Abby Ramsey live quietly in Southend-on-Sea, where Bill now plans to write a novel. There has been no recurrence of the werewolf spirit.
The End. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Werewolf, A True Story of Demonic Possession, by Ed and Lorraine Warren and William Ramsey, with Robert David Chase. Read for you by Todd Habercorn. Text copyright 1991, by Ed and Lorraine Warren and William Ramsey, with Robert David Chase. Production copyright 2017 by Gray Malkin Media, LLC. All rights reserved. For more information about this title and Ed and Lorraine Warren, visit graymalkin.com. That's GRAYMALKIN.com. Thank you for listening.